special Haunted Halloween edition of Novel Ideas Podcast.
Ooh, spooky podcast with two siblings who love scary books.
We love scary books so much
that we read Frankenstein, which frankly isn't all that scary.
Yeah, actually. I guess if it was actually happening to you, it'd be pretty scary.
That's true. If I met an 8-foot tall demon looking thing, that visage is so terrifying that apparently no one can look at its face.
Yeah, and then he strangled you to death?
And then he strangled me to death. That would all be very scary.
But, seeing as that has not happened.
That has not happened.
I feel like I could be friends with that guy.
I know. It's like, okay.
I know tall people.
So he's a big tall thuggo. Big deal.
He can be in the NBA. No one would give a shit. Like, who cares how ugly he is? He can throw a basketball.
That's right.
So, I'm Gabs.
I'm Ben.
And this week, obviously, we are reading Frankenstein by Mary Shelley.
Frankenstein.
Mary Wollencraft.
Wallenstone?
Shit. Shelley. Mary, Shelley. We do have a spoiler policy that we forget about constantly. So I just thought I'd try to remember to mention it this week when spoilers are practically not relevant to this book because it was written in the 1800s.
I mean, this book totally has spoilers, but I don't think I'm spoiling anyone in the traditional usage of the word spoil when I tell all of you, by the way, bail out now if this is going to piss you off. But I don't think I'm spoiling it for anyone when I tell you that Frankenstein is the scientist, not the monster.
Oh my god!
And that the monster kills the shit out of Frankenstein's wife.
He totally does.
Yeah.
Because Frankenstein killed the shit out of his wife. Yeah. Well, his potential wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got scolded last week by a friend who said, you said you didn't have to give a spoiler policy because Brave New World was written in the 30s, but I never fucking read it before. I was like, yeah, it's just because I'm lazy and forget about the spoiler policy. So I make up excuses.
You just go on the offensive when that happens. Well, that's your fault.
Are you some kind of idiot?
Who hasn't read that? Uneducated people. Ignorant slut.
So that one's for you, Jessica. So this is actually a book where the backstory of it is pretty interesting. So I think we're going to start by talking a little bit about that.
Oh.
How the book was originally conceived and written.
Oh, that backstory.
Yeah.
My bad.
Oh, like the backstory to start it out
with? I was like,
what? No.
I didn't think it was that interesting.
No. We're talking about real life.
All right. So Mary Shelley and her husband, Percy?
Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Yes.
Who wrote the poem Ozymandias.
Ah, there you go.
Tying back to the watch.
Noted romantic.
Yes.
And Lord
Byron.
Byron, the poet.
Yeah.
Who wrote all of the poems.
And sexed up, like, 50% of the women in Europe, apparently.
Including one of Mary Shelley's friends, who was also with them on this retreat.
Yes. But not Mary Shelley.
As far as we know, anyway.
I don't think the two of them actually got along very well. They were on this vacation over the summer, and it was, like, the shittiest summer in the world.
It rained constantly.
I think it was actually called, like, the year without a summer.
Yeah, there was a volcano.
Yeah. The volcano eruption ruined all the weather.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was raining, no one could go outside and do anything interesting, and so
they said, it's rainy and dank and unpleasant. Let's have a scary story contest, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Let's all write scary stories and see who writes the best one. And Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. Or the beginning of it, anyway.
Wrote a good chunk of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fun fact, Lord Byron wrote basically a prototypical vampire short story. Called, like, the Wampire or something.
Oh, Lord Byron.
Some people credit him as being one of the first, but who knows?
Yeah, who knows? I'm sure there was some. I'm sure there was some of that information and mythos out there in the ether, so to speak.
Yeah.
Old timey term. for him to develop it, and for Bram Stoker to later do a lot more of it.
Uh huh. But the fact is that this book basically came from a bunch of authors sitting around, two of whom, the two men who are really well known, and Mary Shelley's the one who writes the book that everyone's heard of.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be willing to bet there are people who've heard of Frankenstein who just went, Percy, who? Lord Byron? Never heard of him. You'd be dumb, but... I'm just kidding.
Just kidding, you big dummies.
And we chose the book, as stated, because of Halloween. And because a lot of people read it in school.
Yeah, that too.
I read it in school.
I did not read it in school. But I read your copy while you were in school.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't remember that. You read my annotated copy?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Oh, crazy. Anyway, so let's get into talking a little bit about the book.
Sure, why not? So the book opens with a very romantic gesture.
Oh, yes, yes, it does.
In fact, maybe we should take a step back and say the genre of this book is romantic / horror, and then some folks like to point out it's a precursor to science fiction.
Yes. Can you talk a little bit about why it can be considered science fiction?
Sure. Basically because a scientist makes a monster with science. I mean, that sounds really glib, but that really is the reasoning. And the fact that he uses science and studies for years and studies chemistry and biology and natural philosophy.
Uh-huh.
And actually builds this thing out of parts and doesn't use a magic spell or an incantation or some sort of weird ancient holy book or any of those types of tropes,
uh-huh.
Is significant.
Yeah.
Because it's all through a natural type of cause, which I guess kind of fits the whole Enlightenment thing, which makes sense too.
Right, I should mention this book was written in the early 1800s, I think 1817,
1819. That sounds about right.
All this is kind of sciencey stuff is going on anyway. One of the parallels a lot of people like to draw is this was around the same time these famous experiments were going on where you had the scientist who was studying dead frogs and he would apply electricity to them and they would start twitching on the table. And a lot of people saw this as some form of reanimation, which, of course, we know now that he was just, like, tweaking their nervous systems and...
Right.
making them jump around. But that was really, really fascinating to people, and a lot of people draw that parallel to helping inspire Mary Shelley of this idea of science bringing something to life.
Yeah. And...
Very relevant.
Yes. So now the opening of the book.
Okay.
Which we're going to keep tying back into this romantic idea because this book is very romantic.
And not romantic in the sense of...
This is capital R romantic era movement, whatever you call it. In music, we call it an era.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that there's no sexy times or anything happening in this book.
No, there's a distinct lack of sexy times in this book, in fact. But it opens with letters setting the stage, letters from an Arctic explorer to his sister talking about his mission and what he's doing.
He wants to figure out how magnets work.
Yeah, he wants to figure out how magnets work. And he puts this voyage together.
He seriously
does. I know, I'm giggling because it's ridiculous. And he sails north and they find this dude hanging out on an ice floe.
Mm-hmm.
And when they go to pick him up, the guy says, so, you heading north or south? He's like, we're heading north. Okay, then I'll take your ride. He's like, okay, so the guy's crazy. But then he befriends him.
Dying.
And it turns out to be Victor Frankenstein.
Victor.
Who then goes on to tell the story that is basically the rest of the book.
Yeah, the premise is that when Frankenstein is talking to this young captain and he's talking about all this great exploring he's going to do and he doesn't care if someone has to die for him to do it, Frankenstein goes, oh, I see a little bit of myself in there. I'm going to try to warn this guy so that he doesn't make the same mistakes that I did.
Yes.
This is, like Ben said, a very romantic trope. If you read books from this era, authors love setting up their stories with someone finding someone's papers, with someone randomly meeting a guy who just tells them his story. Almost like they're trying to solidify it as real history or something that happened in the real world, even though everyone who read it would know that it was fiction.
Right. Yeah.
Which,
for an example of something we've podcast, The Scarlet Letter has a massive introduction. Yes. About this, like, trading house, government office, essentially.
The Custom House.
The Custom House, that's what I was looking for. And, I mean, enormous, like 30 pages
mm-hmm.
of him rambling about the Custom House and the colorful personalities that inhabit it, and then, and here are some papers from somewhere. And here's the story, okay. And now the rest of it has nothing to do with any of those people.
Uh-huh. Or the guy who buys the opera house at the beginning of Phantom of the Opera and finds papers and old papers in the office that tell this strange tale of something that happened years ago. I'm not really sure. I think The Three Musketeers actually does that too. And he goes on this huge story about finding random-ass papers, and he actually will interrupt the story to talk about history, and it's ridiculous. But to a modern reader, I actually think that this doesn't hold up very well, because it's typically pretty long and involved, and they tell you a whole bunch about a character that you has nothing to do with the story.
Right.
So it's often just kind of feels like a slog.
It does, or feels like a waste of time, though it is very common. And I think some people pay tribute to it, too. That's probably what William Goldman was going for, The Princess Bride.
Oh, yeah, with his intro to his book.
Yeah.
Oh, The Princess Bride. Might have to cover that sometime.
Yeah, we should put that on the list.
So that's our first hint of romanticism that's going on in this book. But then we get to the real meat of the book, which is the story of Victor Frankenstein and his journey in creating his monster.
Yeah, Victor loves to read. He's a smart guy. Reads a lot of old-school natural philosophers, like Cornelius Agrippa, and Albert Magnus, and Paracelsus. And for those of you who are fans of Fullmetal Alchemist, Paracelsus, also known as Van Hohenheim.
Yeah, real name, Van Hohenheim, which I loved when I figured that out. One of the things I actually did really like when he first discovered those books and showed them to his dad, and his dad just said, don't read those, they're trash. And then he said, well, because he didn't explain why they were trash, that just made me want to read them more.
teenagers, lol.
Yep.
Never change.
Even Victor Frankenstein.
Very contrarian. And so he goes off to university and...
Yeah, he wants to study science.
Starts learning some real science. And there's one professor who's kind of a dick about it and one who's nice about it and...
They're not that important.
Yeah, I mean, this is several... We're glossing over several chapters right now, but you can.
It's barely worth mentioning.
Yeah. And so he builds this thing. He figures out how to create life.
Yeah, basically, he becomes so obsessed with science, discovering the nature of living, that he figures out how to actually create life.
Yes.
That has nothing to do with sex, by the way.
Right.
Should mention that.
How do you create life? Well, there's a real easy way. That's not what I mean.
Call up Elizabeth. Duh.
Victor wouldn't know what you were talking about.
No, he'd be like, what's a...
Elizabeth? What does Elizabeth have to do with me creating life?
Dude.
You see,
that's
Victor.
Why you need to call up Elizabeth.
You see, Victor, when a man loves a woman... Preferably one who hasn't been raised basically as his sister. Yeah, about that. What he does is he puts it in.
I also like that as a trope of old books. You know, oh, we raised this young girl as our ward, and we always dreamed that when she grew up, she would marry our son. What? What's wrong with you people?
It's a really annoying anime trope, too. The stepsister thing.
It's just, I think it's kind of everywhere in fiction.
Yeah.
But it makes very little sense to me, because it's basically, it's been proven more or less through various studies that if kids grow up together, even if they're in different families, they basically, they form these brother-sister attachments and are not interested romantically in each other when they grow up.
It is interesting to me that this trope came into existence on opposite sides of the globe, essentially, though.
Uh-huh. There's gotta be some truth to it somewhere. I mean, people were forcing cousins to marry each other, noble families a lot, so.
True enough, yeah.
Veering off course for a bit there. Yes, yeah, so Frankenstein discovers how to create life with science. And then he does.
And then he meets the life he created, freaks out, and refuses to have anything to do with it.
I will say that up until this point, I don't really care that much about Frankenstein's character. I'm always interested in science, always obsessed with his work, whatever. The second he creates the monster, immediately runs away from it and refuses to talk to it or have any interaction with it whatsoever, I went, okay, you're a dick.
You're an idiot. What are you doing?
You immediately turn into a stupid.
I really got hung up on that because he flees his apartment and then he comes back and he's like, oh, thank God it's gone. And basically doesn't give it a thought for months.
Yes. I mean, he does get sick because of it.
Right.
But yeah, doesn't think about it. Pretty much moves on from it, isn't even interested in science anymore, and it isn't until the monster kills his little brother that it comes back into his life. And this is, like, 2 years later.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a ridiculous amount of time has passed.
Time
this
passes,
isn't a
like...
a month.
Yeah, time passes like nothing in this book, by the way. Like, there are several months between every chapter, I'm convinced.
Which is actually one of the things we discussed, another part of the romantic setting of the book, is that Victor gets these horrible, debilitating fevers every time his psyche's messed up, which is a lot.
Right.
Because he's so horrified. And so he's sick for, you know, 2, 3, 4 months after his initial creation of the monster. And that is a very old school thing to happen in books, to have characters fall into fits of passion and be sick for 3 months at a time.
Pride and Prejudice.
Very pretty common in Jane Austen, actually. Sense and Sensibility.
More so.
Way more in Sense and Sensibility.
Way more so in Sense and Sensibility. We just haven't done a podcast on that.
And then Persuasion.
I was thinking more like Jane catches a cold and can't be moved because it's too dangerous.
Almost dies
for several days, which is kind of silly.
I'm trying to think of another example, and I can't off the top of my head, which is not doing a very good job of proving this is common. Actually, it reminded me of Dracula. When Jonathan Harker, after he escapes Dracula, gets that brain fever for months and months and months.
Man brain fever.
Yeah, it's how they deal with the horror of what they've experienced. Yeah. But yes, he doesn't think about this monster until, you know, 2 years later.
Yeah.
And then, even then, when he runs into it, again, refuses to speak to it. It does kill his little brother, but at this point, he doesn't even know that it actually killed his little brother. And he just won't even.
Right. He goes home, and he thinks he sees the monster, and he's like, the monster did it.
Yeah. I thought I caught a glimpse of a man in the corner of my eye. Monster. It reminds me of those Ghost Hunter shows.
Yes.
What was that? Oh, there's a fleck on the camera. It's totally a ghost.
That's proof.
Guys, you're totally being a Victor Frankenstein right now.
Yeah, stop being a Vic. Stop being Vic the Dick. And, I don't know, just like, I feel like every episode that happens does nothing to make Victor Frankenstein come across as charming or having a strong character, which is what our captain, our letter-writing ship captain, would have us believe in the beginning and the very end.
That is one of the problems, is that he spends so much of the books being melancholy and paranoid and a jerk and totally upset and unlike himself, but in that couple chapters you get before he becomes unlike himself, he's not that charming or interesting.
Yeah, that melancholy thing just isn't in anymore.
Another romantic.
Now we're like, cheer up, emo kid.
What you doing, Victor?
What's up, buddy?
You need some Prozac there, buddy?
You need some sunshine? Come on, bud, let's go outside.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the monster's character?
Yeah, let's do it.
Since we've been complaining about Frickazai.
This monster is very eloquent. That's the first thing.
Oh my goodness.
That strikes you.
Yes.
If all you know is the Frankenstein cultural reference, you do not expect the monster to speak in complete sentences, let alone be a persuasive and charming devil.
Yes. The Hollywood version of Frankenstein, I don't know why they did it. It must have been, oh, people won't believe a monstrous-looking creature to speak well. Must have been their inspiration for it.
Maybe.
I don't really know. I actually think that the actual version of the monster is way, way better.
Yeah.
So I don't really know why they did it. I guess what can you expect from a guy who learns to speak from French nobles and then reads Paradise Lost a bunch?
You're right.
Gotta be pretty well spoken. But yes, this monster is incredibly eloquent. He is more eloquent than the human beings around him, for sure, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually, I think, at the very end, that's something Frankenstein was warning people about, or was warning maybe the captain about. He said, if you meet this creature, it is persuasive. Do not listen to him, for he is a fiend! It's like, he wasn't gonna be bad. He told you he was only killing people because you made him lonely, essentially.
Yeah, this is the part that really solidifies my dislike of Frankenstein the man, is that he hates the monster from the very beginning, but then everything the monster is telling him, you know, I got abandoned, I didn't know I had to eat, I didn't know how to keep myself warm, I couldn't speak, I couldn't read, no one would talk to me. His life was really shitty. And he genuinely wanted to have relationships with people and friendships and have people care about him. And he finishes saying all this stuff and Frankenstein's just, you're a monster.
Devil, demon, wretch.
Did you even listen to anything this guy just said? What's wrong with you?
He just wants someone to talk to him and you won't even look him in the face. You made the damn thing. You were staring at it for like 2 years.
Yeah. The second it opens its eyes, you run away in horror. I mean, come on. You're the worst.
Not a good start.
No. And the monster story is pretty affecting. I will say that while I sympathize with him, there is a huge element of creepy. And the fact that he's basically just spying on this family for months straight.
So you wonder how he gets away with it when they live in, like, a tiny cottage in the middle of the woods.
Yeah. Whatever that lean-to or hovel is attached to the cabin. Yeah. I'm not sure exactly how that works.
Just staring through a knothole.
Uh-huh. But he learns how to speak and how to read because of these people he's been watching, learning how to interact and how people care about each other. He does little good deeds for them, cuts up their wood, because he notices that Felix, the man, sometimes has to waste a lot of the day cutting wood for them, and so he'll go and do it at night while they're all sleeping.
Yeah. He's a big, strong monster man.
Uh-huh.
He can cut, like, a week's worth of wood in one night.
Uh-huh. They'll just find this huge stockpile of wood and go, oh.
Cool.
Cool.
Thanks, unseen person.
They take that pretty well.
Yeah, they don't get too hung up on it, it sounds like. Also, you would think that he might have mentioned that when he revealed himself to them.
Yeah, I'm the guy who's been cutting your wood.
I'm the guy who's been cutting your wood. I'm friendly.
That whole encounter, I don't know, it just sounds like people are so hung up on the way he looks that they won't even for a second listen to anything he has to say.
He's got to be scary looking.
That's the only thing I can think.
Everyone is horrified the second they lay eyes on him.
But I don't know how that happened either, because Frankenstein himself wasn't horrified by how he looked until, like I said, until he opened his eyes.
Yeah.
He wanted to make this big, strong guy who was impressive and powerful, but then somehow made him monstrously hideous.
Something about the eyes.
Yellow.
Maybe that's the key component. One of those eyes are the window of the soul things, and he has no soul.
I guess. But he sounds like he has a soul. He has the soul of a poet.
Yeah, I was going to say. I don't know how you want to define soul, but if soul means you can walk around and have feelings, then he fits that definition pretty well.
Yeah. So, let's talk a little bit about the intended characterization here, because I think it's really common. I remember when I read it in high school, a lot of people in the class did feel somewhat sorry for the monster.
Mm-hmm.
Liked him pretty well. We were all really surprised that he could talk so well.
Yeah.
And I think I liked Frankenstein better and the guy better in high school than I did reading it this time, but I still found the monster more sympathetic than the man who made him.
The monster seems to fit the protagonist type of role better, even though Frankenstein is pretty clearly the protagonist in this story. But, like, he's the one who has feelings and his character changes over the course of the story, and who has to deal with real hardships, whereas Frankenstein's this melancholy scientist dude, and I mean, he's affected by some of the things that happens because, you know, like, his best friend and his family ends up getting murdered, but he doesn't really grow as a person. He starts out with the horror, and then when the monster starts murdering people, he just hates it even more.
Uh-huh.
And so he just gets more and more full of hate as the story goes along.
And so does the monster, for that matter.
True.
You can make the argument that the monster is ultimately unsympathetic when he's murdering a bunch of people horrendously.
I mean, that's true. You definitely don't approve of what he's doing, but you understand his motivations. Whereas with Frankenstein himself, you get this more vague, monster!
Uh-huh. And there's part for the monster, too. You know, he wasn't always in a murderous rampage.
Right.
But you can kind of think of it of the way of the people who grow up to become criminals, and a lot of them, you know, grew up in bad areas or in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, society expects me to be a criminal, so I'm going to be a criminal.
Right.
And sort of the same thing happens to the monster of, no one will give me a chance, and they all think I'm a horrible monster, so I'm going to be a horrible monster.
Poor monster, he just needed a hug.
Yeah, just needed a friend.
Gabs would have chatted with him.
Totally would have. So that, that was kind of interesting, and we kind of wondered if Mary Shelley's intended purpose was the way we've been reading the characters. I thought there was a pretty interesting quote by Stephen King talking about one of the themes of the book, where he says, "Its classical unity is broken only by the author's uncertainty as to where the fatal flaw lies. Is it in Victor's hubris, usurping a power that belongs only to God, or in his failure to take responsibility for his creation after endowing it with the life spark?" So, is the monster just a monster from the beginning because it's unnatural, or should Victor have given him some bro hugs and
yeah.
Everything would have turned out all right?
So, I think that
my thinking on this matter is that when the book was written, the audiences probably would have tended to lean towards the former interpretation, and I think reading it as a modern reader, you tend to lean more towards the latter. I'm not gonna say that's universal in either case, but that's a gut feeling more than anything. But I mean, the modern readers, I guess that's a silly thing to say. The people I know who've read it, none of whom were from the early 19th century. If you are, by the way, leave us a comment.
Yes. still waiting on those old English gentlemen from Bram Stoker.
That's right. But generally have had some sympathy for the monster, certainly more so than for Victor Frankenstein. And it seems really unfair that he calls this thing monster and demon and devil and wretch when, like, as far as he knows, it hasn't done anything. Now, right after he's calling it that, it then tells him that it did, in fact, murder his youngest brother.
Yes.
But still, whereas I think the idea of a man creating something, creating life using science, would certainly be an affront to the view of the universe people had at that time, and that some people would still have today, because it's kind of a godless creation that way.
One more thing I did want to mention really quick is the reason the monster murders his little brother in the first place is because he realizes that he and Victor Frankenstein are related to each other. Because he goes, oh, little boy, maybe he won't be horrified by me. Maybe we can become friends. And then William's, you know, oh, gross, get away from me. No, we're going to be friends, I'm going to go tell my dad, Mr. Frankenstein, on you. And then he goes, oh, you're related to Frankenstein? Murder.
Joke.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have done anything to him.
Yeah, he's just trying to be buddies with a 5-year-old.
So, something to think about.
Yes.
Well, I guess we can move on to some issues.
Let's do it.
All right. So, and talk about the feminist perspective a little bit, because we always do.
Yeah, and there's actually with this book, there's been a pretty good amount of writing and speculation from a feminist perspective.
We should mention maybe that Mary Shelley grew up with two parents who were scholars, and her mother was actually an academic, and so she grew up with a female role model, and knew women could be smart and all that sort of stuff, so she had that background already,
right.
Which I think is why some people take the feminist interpretation to it.
Right.
Because they think, well, she had some kind of...
Well, not to mention a woman author.
Yep.
In 1818 or whenever.
Uh-huh. So, there are a good number of female characters. Unlike a lot of the other books we've read, there's actually pretty even balance between female and male characters. They don't really get that much development. Although a lot of the male characters don't get that much development either.
Yeah, to be fair, it's Victor and the monster, and then everyone else is extremely secondary.
I'd say Elizabeth is the most important female character. She's Victor's pseudo-sister slash love interest.
And I think she exists as a role rather than a character, almost.
Yes.
It's like, okay, well, here's the love interest, here's the, well, kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Unconditional love of Victor, I think. And I think to some degree she's supposed to help redeem him.
Well, she's also the ideal of feminine virtue.
Right, right. Which is why Victor's mother wanted so badly for them to marry someday. But, I mean, you just get a couple letters from her. That's all you get as far as characterization goes. And then you actually get a little more from Justine, who was another surrogate of theirs. Or was she just a friend of the family?
Yes. I think she was an aunt's servant, because she was of lower birth than Elizabeth, but she was treated well and actually started getting an education and other things once they realized that she was...
Right.
So, yeah, basically another ward type.
But here's a woman of low birth who is realizing some of her potential, so I guess that ties into the feminism thing a little as well. She is ultimately unjustly executed for...
Really fast, too.
Yeah, like, in a hurry. For William's death, basically because she had a picture in her pocket and she slept in a barn.
Literally. I'm
fairly serious, yeah. And this is... I think it's a little bit of a romantic thing, too. She's very accepting of her death.
Uh-huh.
He's like, well, at least I have people who believe in me at the end. Like, that wouldn't be enough to make me not be bitter.
I'll be reunited with William, and she even confesses at the end just because mm-hmm. she realizes that she can't get out of it, so.
That was an error in my mind, though.
I thought so, too, because that helped sway people who believed she was innocent.
Right. They could have had a last second stay of execution yeah. otherwise. But, yeah. So, those are some women's roles. One of the things I read earlier today, doing my usual light research, internet, was that one of the ideas put out there by one of the feminist critics that I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but I know, bad scholarship by me, but the idea that part of the purpose of the book was to show what would happen when a man created life without the help of a woman.
Which I thought was really interesting,
actually. I think that is a really interesting take, enough so to bring it up, because he builds this thing kind of out of arrogance without any thought to the possible consequences.
Uh-huh.
And then does nothing to nurture it, which mm-hmm. is usually considered a female virtue.
Uh-huh.
And look what happens. It goes on a crazy murder spree.
Becomes a monster.
Monster just needed a mother.
I also thought, when Ben mentioned this, it was pretty interesting because one of these scholars that Frankenstein had been reading was Paracelsus, who is an old school alchemist. And he actually wrote instructions. This is the actual Paracelsus.
Yeah, we're going history here.
Actually wrote instructions for people if they wanted to create a homunculus, which is not really a well-known monster today, but in medieval Renaissance times it was a lot more well-known. A homunculus is essentially a little created person that scientists make. And the instructions, or the typical myth behind it, is that you throw all your stuff together, but the seed you use to bring it to life is semen. But that's it. You don't use anything from a lady, and so they speculate, you know, this is one of the reasons homunculi were considered monsters, is because they were created only of a man and not of a woman as well. So, we were kind of speculating that the fact Victor read some Paracelsus, and then he was the one to create the monster without any help from a woman, and the monster's kind of a homunculus.
If I had to label it, I think I might go with that.
There's no mention of semen, but...
Yeah, but you did mention he was collecting parts, so who knows what ingredients went into this thing.
Uh-huh. That was a cool tie-in.
Yeah.
One of the other things tied into women's issues a bit, as well as a little bit of race, I guess, sprinkled in there, is the cottagers that the monster's spying on. He finds out that these peasants are actually exiled noblemen from France, which...
Another romantic trope.
I think I texted Ben, welcome to books where all peasants are exiled noblemen.
Right, why are peasants who are just peasants any less interesting than peasants who are exiled noblemen? I mean, unless you have, like, a huge plot that revolves around it. That's uh-huh. obvious. But if they're just, like, people who exist, and you're learning things about human warmth and family interaction, why couldn't they have just been peasants?
Yeah. I mean, maybe they wouldn't have spoken as well or been able to read.
I guess.
Maybe. But, yeah, I thought, can't they just be peasants? One of the women who ends up joining their group, Safi or Safi, we're not sure how to pronounce it, but she is originally from Turkey and basically ran away from her dad because he was being a huge jackass. But it's mentioned that, you know, I think they say she's Muhammad's, a daughter of Muhammad, or basically she's Muslim.
Right.
And she's been in France, and her father wants to take her back to Turkey and marry her off and do all that stuff. And she really, really doesn't want to go back. She wants to stay. She wants to become a Christian. And this is a trope you'll find from time to time in older books of, you know, these noble foreigners who want to become Christians and better themselves. But it's interesting that in this book, she doesn't want to just become virtuous and Christian. She doesn't want to be Muslim and go back to Turkey because women can't get the education and scholarship that she's been learning in France. And she wants to continue learning. And she can't do that if her dad sends her back home.
Yeah, the consistency between the female characters in this book is that all of them are well-educated.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, as a child of two scholars with a good education, I guess it's not that surprising that Mary Shelley might hold that as a value. But, yeah, she liked her some educated women in her
book. Yeah, yeah. it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, I mean, kind of as a semi-professional segue from feminist issues, but Frankenstein wanted a wife. Or, yes. Excuse me, Frankenstein's monster wanted a wife.
Yes.
Frankenstein also wanted a wife.
But he had one line.
But he had one in line, yes. And is that, like, the whole purpose? Is that where the Bride of Frankenstein came from,
yes.
Probably?
Yes, yep.
I'm sure. But anyway, he builds this wife almost to completion.
The monster basically makes this deal with him. If you create me a mate, someone won't be, you know, horrified by me, like all mankind is.
Right.
Then she and I will go off and live somewhere where we don't have to worry about being rejected by people. And if we have each other as company, then we'll be happy.
Right.
And Frankenstein doesn't really want to do it, but can't really see a way out of it. So he, okay.
And then at the last possible minute, kind of goes, well, wait, what if she doesn't like him and then they're both lonely and they both go on murder sprees? Or what if they go populate some savage, wild continent like North America with monster babies?
Yeah. We can't have that. And then he notices the monster looking in the window. And right in front of the monster's eyes, just starts tearing this potential bride to pieces.
He destroys it. I don't know how. In my mind, he picks up an axe and just starts chopping up everything.
God. I just imagine him, like, just ripping her limbs off and stuff.
Your way might be more violent than mine.
I don't know. But yeah, obviously, monster's a bit put out by this.
A bit put out?
A bit. What are you doing?
You're chopping on my wife, yo!
Yeah. Frankenstein's, beast, I will never listen to you again. Be gone, devil.
He's like, fine. Murder time. I'll see you on your wedding night.
Boop, boop, doop,
boop. Boop, 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 doop, doop. Exit stage right.
And this, we should mention this phrase, I'll see you on your wedding night, is repeated multiple times after he says it. Victor dwells on it.
Yeah. He's like, oh, he's going to come kill me on my wedding night. He's going to wait for me to think I'm happy and then kill me. What a bastard. I'll carry a pistol.
Yes.
And meanwhile, every person in the history of time who has ever read this book is like, he's going to kill your wife.
Duh. I mean, Victor's not the most genre-savvy of protagonists.
That's fair.
But just think, okay, parallelism, guys, you know, oh, I just killed your wife in front of you, so as revenge, you're gonna kill me. Oh, no, wait, you're gonna kill my wife.
Oh.
And this is the same shit they pulled in Dracula, where, you know, oh, people are in danger, let's fuck it up as much as possible and let Lucy die.
Let's protect Lucy by always forgetting to watch her door every single night.
Yes.
She's all pale every morning. What's up?
What's going on? Mina's the only one who's smart enough to stay with her. But it's kind of the same thing. The monster must be after me. Hey, Elizabeth, just go into her room and close the door. I'll be back in a couple hours.
Yeah, you'll be safe behind a closed door. No 8-foot-tall superhuman could ever breach that impenetrable security.
And he doesn't even really consider her in danger because he thinks it's after him.
Right.
So he leaves her alone.
I'm going to go hunt down this superhuman opponent with a single-shot flintlock pistol. I'm going to win.
Yeah. Why don't you sit in your room with your wife and wait for the monster to come?
Yeah. Why don't you drag the bureau in front of the door and sit there aiming your single-shot flintlock pistol at the window all night?
Yeah. It's so stupid.
Come and get it.
It's just one of those totally, you're an idiot moments.
Yep.
The monster killed your little brother. The monster kills your best friend, who we haven't mentioned up until this point. But
right.
The monster kills Henry Clerval's best friend. And he thinks it's going to kill him next instead of the rest of his family.
Right. He's trying to make you as miserable as possible. He's not trying to end you.
Yeah. Otherwise, he would have killed you when he witnessed the destruction of his bride.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll see you on your wedding night. Like, if he wanted you dead, he would have just choked you out right there.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. Took care of that. Guess I'll, do whatever monsters do.
Go hang out somewhere.
Go throw a mash.
I'm gonna go find Dracula and the Wolfman, guys. Don't even worry about it. It is quite a stupid moment for Victor, and I was just mad at him when I was reading that.
You don't have to be, like, fourth wall penetrating genre savvy, but come on. Like, have a clue.
Yeah. Especially after his friend gets killed.
Right.
It's pretty obvious what's happening.
Yeah.
And so we should mention, you know, after that happens, his father dies of a broken heart.
As you do.
And then he goes chasing after the monster, and ultimately the monster does kill him. But, because in books, revenge is never, you know, satisfying.
That's true.
The monster regrets what he's done and doesn't feel any better and has to go atone for his sins by setting himself on fire. That's apparently also what you do.
Yeah, you know. Oh, remorse. Well, I guess I'll go kill myself in the fire.
In the middle of the Arctic, I'll somehow set myself on fire.
He'll get it figured out. He's resourceful. He's pretty smart.
It's just kind of ridiculous.
I still think he changes his mind before he gets that far.
That's dumb. I think he becomes Santa Claus. Yeah,
that's right.
He goes, I don't want to kill myself. I'll just set up shop here on the North Pole. Then he becomes Santa. Obviously.
Duh.
So, there's one other, I guess, character that we haven't really talked about, and that's the various settings of the book. One of the things that makes this book romantic is the fact that a lot of it's spent out in nature, and they go, Victor traverses into the awesome, sublime, amazing nature constantly.
Yes.
So when he actually runs into the monster, he's just, you know, climbed a mountain, and then he goes and he's running around the Scottish, the isolated Scottish islands or whatever.
Right. They're traveling across the countryside, and he's like, well, this isn't as cool as the Alps, and then they get into the Highlands, and he's like, ooh, this
yeah.
Nature is amazing.
Uh-huh. And it almost, a couple times, nature almost manages to restore him, make him temporarily forget about this horror, but he always comes back to it.
Yeah.
And then it begins and ends in the Arctic, which is one of the most extreme, you know, forces of nature
right.
You could be in. Mary Shelley said, well, this relationship is going to be more dramatic if I put it in the Arctic. which is helping, you know, nature set the scene is.
Right.
And it really, there's a lot of description of
scenery
of it too.
Yeah.
Yes.
And kind of in opposition to the monster, which is unnatural.
Uh-huh.
As unnatural
science
as you
created.
Can get.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
There's a quote in the book where I noticed Victor mentioning that at this point, you know, nature had almost restored him and made him forget what had happened, but he was too bound by iron and had to return to his melancholy, basically. This idea of science intervening with nature and turning it wrong and somehow being a bad force, which romantics liked to consider.
They would go for that, yeah.
There are moments, I think Ben mentioned, probably, I think before we started recording, that are very transcendental.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and tell you I'm an expert on transcendentalism, but certainly, like, the idea of nature and of, like, there are some kind of spiritual qualities to things, but none of them are related to God. They're all related to the majesty of nature.
And the power of nature.
Right.
You know, mountains and...
Right.
Snowstorms and all that stuff. And
ice flows trapping you. And like, suddenly separating, preventing you from chasing, your revenge. Rather than the monster just turning around and being like, what's up, and choking him.
Which would make for a much shorter book.
yes, it would.
So, yes. Nature is a big theme of the book. Science and unnatural versus the natural, definitely in there. And then, as we've mentioned already, but this isolation versus acceptance. So, obviously, with the monster, everyone rejects him. No one will love him. And then Victor, as he becomes more and more wrapped up in this horror and this obsession, he doesn't want to be around people.
Yeah, and his isolation makes him sicker and sicker, actually. So yeah. He's suffering some of the same issues as the monster, which is, I'm part of the monster's intent.
Kind of deserves it.
Yeah, well.
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah. It's hard to feel too bad for Victor. Feel bad for his family members who got killed, but...
unnecessarily. You want to wrap up?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so strengths and weaknesses of the writing.
Well, as we've mentioned probably about 14 times by now, it is extremely romantic, and it is a really good, in the sense of representative, example of that.
The descriptions of nature, the way people speak.
Yeah, I mean, the prose itself.
It's well done.
Yeah, I mean, it's good writing, too, I think. You could definitely argue, especially since the idiom it's in is no longer in use, that it could use some editing. Like the first several chapters, you could reduce to a couple of paragraphs without losing anything important to the story. The bookends are too much.
That's what I was in, and I mentioned in the beginning that I think the frame narrative is... doesn't really work so much with the modern reader.
Right.
And isn't... I guess it's kind of necessary because after Frankenstein dies, someone has to be there to witness what the monster's going to do. Right. But there is more of it, I think, than there needs to be. That said, it is a fairly tightly plotted book. There's actually a pretty good amount of action in it. Aside from the languishing around for 2 and 3 months at a time. which, again, passes so quickly, it's not usually a huge deal.
Right.
So.
But, I mean, it is pretty much moving event to event. And
it's not terribly long.
I mean, yeah, and even if, you know, if I say, well, you could cut the first 5 chapters, well, it takes all of 10 minutes to read those 5 chapters. They're real short. Most of the chapters are actually... pretty short, but the more exposition-y ones are even shorter. The whole book is not very long.
No.
It probably took me maybe 3 hours to read the whole thing. Probably less than that.
Oh, probably more than that for me, I would say.
Yeah, well.
I spent like 2.5 solid hours and then some sprinkled in there. Yeah. But, And again, not everyone reads as fast as Ben, so you probably won't be able to read in 3 hours.
Yeah, I'm afraid.
But it's not going to take you forever.
Right. Yeah, I mean, a book is a little more investment than a movie usually in terms of finishing time, but it's not something where it's going to take you 3 weeks to work your way through it.
It's not Game of Thrones.
No, it's not A Feast for Crows.
Which I still haven't.
Oh, no.
We'll get to that later. So context and relevance.
Well, it is frequently assigned.
And we both read it in school, which means, I read it in
school.
You read
it in school.
My bad. Apparently no one else has to read it in school. Frankenstein is a classic movie, or just villain, monster in general.
Cultural reference, icon, whatever you want to call it. The theme, the isolation versus acceptance thing, is very much an issue for people, especially for teenagers, which is the age group that usually gets assigned the book.
And as far as books to read for class goes, I liked it, actually. Mm-hmm. I think a fair amount of people who had to read in my class liked it pretty well, too. Like we said, it's not so long that you start dragging. And although the prose is a little dense at times, it's not difficult.
Yeah, and you know, I think one of the big issues with reading something that's written in a more archaic style is that if it's long, classes, students have difficulty getting through it.
Mm-hmm.
And with this book, even if it was a little bit tougher read, it's not so long that they couldn't get through it. And since it's chaptered so easily, too, like, you can easily do, hey, three chapters at a time, which shouldn't take you more than, I mean, depending on which three chapters you're reading, but, like, honestly, even for someone who reads much slower than I do, that's a half hour of investment.
Mm-hmm. Especially, I was thinking, The Scarlet Letter is also a shorter book, but I think Frankenstein's much easier to get through than The Scarlet Letter.
I agree, actually.
So,
Scarlet Letter has some challenges to it.
That is some dense prose.
Yeah, it really, really is.
Whereas Frankenstein, if you get bored a little bit and skim, you actually can pull it off.
Yeah, and I'm not usually a skimmer, even though I read fast, but with this book, I did a little bit. Some of the extended prose sections, I would find myself a little farther ahead than I knew I should be, because, like, you don't need all 17 adjectives in every paragraph. You just don't. And so, yeah, I mean, what the heck? Hit it, tackle it, right?
Yeah. And I, for anybody who listened to the Dracula podcast, you'll remember that I actually recommended this book for people who wanted to read a monster story but didn't want to invest in Dracula. And I will still maintain that it is better than Dracula.
I thoroughly agree. It's maybe a third of the length, and it is twice as entertaining.
But we did have some issues with the Dracula. Especially Ben.
Yes.
So Ben, what are you reading right now?
Well, I am reading Ghost Story, which is the last volume of the Dresden Files that has been published so far. It may be the last one overall. I don't know. That seems plausible to me. I won't give you guys the giant spoiler that the author insists is not a spoiler or a cliffhanger, but I think most people disagree with him. I think there'll be no more Dresden Files for me within a couple of weeks at the outside.
Aww.
It's very sad.
Like I said, I'm still reading the same stuff. In my defense, I have been trying to finish writing a book this past week.
223,000 words?
Something like that. So yeah, last night I just finished writing a book. I've been a little preoccupied. And tomorrow starts a new journey, which means that I don't know how much I'll read in November.
Yes, either. we are recording on Halloween night, by the way.
That's why it's a spooky
podcast.
Which actually leads us to our little plug. Both Ben and I will be participating in National Novel Writing Month.
NaNoWriMo, or Nano for Nano. even shorter.
I've done it every year since high school. I don't know how many years you've attempted it.
I've attempted it several of those years.
But basically, for anyone who's interested or wants to check it out, you can just Google it. But it's a challenge to write 50,000 words in the month of November, typically to finish it, but a lot of people who have bigger books in mind, because 50,000 is really novella length.
Right.
Just to write the first 50,000 words of it.
Right.
The book I just finished actually originated in the month of November a couple of years ago.
It's so long it got double nanoed.
It did get double nanoed. And I would recommend anyone who really likes to read, even if you haven't really written before, but always kind of thought you might like to try, give it a shot. It comes out to about 1,600 words a day, which actually is kind of a lot when you are factoring in life. But the purpose of it is to get you to write as much as possible in a short amount of time as possible, so you can't sit there and go, oh, this isn't developed enough, this isn't happening. It's made to get rid of that inner editor and downer and just fly by the seat of your pants.
I've read a lot of writing advice that says it's important to get past that, but I wouldn't know since I try and fail every year. That's part of our tradition, too. Gab's knocks out her 50,000 words like a champ!
Yeah!
And I get somewhere between 10 and 30,000 words in, and then
jump out.
Kind of lose interest, yeah.
So what you gotta do is, when you hit that point, is you gotta make something really exciting happen, just out of nowhere.
And just kill some for no reason.
Yeah, exactly. So, I would recommend everyone go check that out. Maybe participate. Don't be a wimp.
That's right.
Give it a shot. And with that, I guess we're pretty much done. So, if you'd like to leave us a comment, you can visit our website at www.novelideaspodcast.com.
Or you can send us an email if you do that. Apparently no one does.
No one does.
NovelIdeasPodcast@gmail.com.
You can follow us on Twitter at NovelIdeasPod.
And if you're an iTunes listener, ratings, reviews, comments, any place they'll let you, go to other people's podcasts and comment on how awesome Novel Ideas is.
Yeah. I found another book podcast on iTunes with way more listeners than us, but they're connected to some greater podcasting hub.
Ah.
So they had built-in listeners. A bunch of chumps.
We'll have to hit them up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can do all of those things if you want to talk to us or yell at us or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who actually read the schedule section of our website, it lies.
We've been lying about reading Ready Player One for a couple of weeks now.
So if you're really looking forward to that, we're not doing that next week.
No, we're postponing it for another week.
Yeah, we'll be doing Tuck Everlasting next week.
We actually just got our hands on Ready Player One, which is the reasoning for that.
I blame UPS, who can't figure out how to drop a package off on my doorstep, even though they've done it 1,000 times.
Yeah. So, we'll be doing Tuck Everlasting, hopefully back on schedule on Tuesday for next week, and then Ready Player One for the following week.
And eventually the website will reflect that.
We'll figure it out.
Probably tomorrow when I post this episode. So, that should do it for this week, and we'll see you next time.
Be gone, monster!
Whoa!